For the next 9 weeks, I've got Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. And so, near the end of this class and each class, I want to make sure we discuss things that you've thought of while we're going through the class. Keep in mind, how do I apply this to my life? What's a lesson that I can learn today from Job, from the book of Job? What can I learn? What have I learned, and how can I apply that to my life? So, since we are beginning with these, I'm beginning with these five books, I'd like to just give us a short paragraph on each one of the books, and then we'll go back and we'll begin with the book of Job. Job was a righteous man that suffered great affliction, as we all know, through no fault of his own. It didn't happen because he had sinned. Actually, quite the opposite. He was called the most righteous man of all the East. He displayed humility, patience, perseverance, and faithfulness during great suffering without sinning, and was rewarded by God. Far as I know, we do not know who the author of the book of Job is. If you do, speak up. But it was an early book of the Bible, and I probably better not say any more, but we'll get into that when we start over. Book of Psalms, of course, is the longest book in the Bible, the story of God's people from creation through the life of King David. Psalms covers almost any subject we can think of, but its central theme is praise to God. The Psalms were set to music, and the people sang them with musical accompaniment or instruments. And basically what they did was they sang the song of their history and of praises to God. And most of them were written by David the king. Proverbs is a collection of words of wisdom, both spiritual and temporal, for everyday life and how to get wisdom. These are just my words. You may have a different, somewhat a different definition, but they're spoken by Solomon the king, who had been given wealth, wisdom, and power greater than any man who ever lived. He had everything in excess, and he did all things in excess, including sin, when he turned from God. Ecclesiastes was also written by Solomon, and he declared all things, all physical things under the sun, are vanity. And gave instruction to seek the Creator while we are still young and able to obey Him. And this was probably written towards the end of his life. And then the Song of Solomon is a book of metaphors, a love story written by and about Solomon and his beautiful Shulamite bride. The book has many comparisons to Israel as God's children and today's church as the bride of Christ. So that just gives us a little something to think about during the next few weeks. So let's go back to Job. And what I want to do today is I do want to look at the first and second chapter in detail, because that gives a great part of the story. Next week we'll look at a little bit. We'll look somewhat at his three friends and their long, long discourses. But we're not going to go into great detail on that. We'd never get done with all of the books if we did. But I think it's important that we do look at the first and second chapter of Job in more detail so we can understand it better. Let me read just a couple of verses here and then we'll get it set. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Then it tells us about his great possessions, verse 4. And his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did regularly. Okay, there's a lot of information about Job, when he lived, his family, and different things there. What are some of the things that you can pick out from those verses?
Blameless.
Right.
He feared the Lord. It doesn't say that, but you can tell he does by his actions.
Well, verse 1 in my translation does say he feared God.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. What else?
I think it's interesting that a lot of people in the Bible, they talk about their wealth in gold and silver, and his wealth was in just cattle and possession. You know, that verse 3 talks about 7,000 sheep, 3,000, you know, all the stuff he had. So we know he's wealthy, but in kind of herds, I guess you would say.
In, later on in the book, it does talk about how he was very generous to people who in need. And he did have great monetary wealth also. And he gave of that. He was very generous. What else can we think of?
He's from Uz.
Yeah?
I checked the map, but I can't find it. I'm not sure we know where it is.
Well, I think we do. In fact, that leads me right into my next thought here. Apparently it was south of Palestine, probably in Mesopotamia, near the Arabian Desert. We know that from the story we're about to get into, when his sons and daughters were killed and all the livestock taken, there were Sabaeans, and I believe it was it Chaldeans? Yeah, verse 17. We know that those groups of people were the ones that raided and murdered and stole from him, and they were countries nearby. So that helps us get a handle on where he was from. Job was also mentioned, if you want to turn quickly to Ezekiel chapter 14, verses 14 through 20. I'm not going to read all that. But Job was mentioned in the same verses with Noah and Daniel as being righteous. And not just righteous, but righteous to the point where when everyone around them was wicked, the whole nation, they were still righteous, those three men. And Job was mentioned by Ezekiel in the same line of thought. That tells us how righteous he was. He wasn't just a good man. He was absolutely outstanding, we might say.
And he sanctified his family. In other words, he set them apart to be holy, I think.
Right.
He wanted
them. Right, and he offered sacrifices for them, so that tells us he was lived in the patriarchal period also. The head of the household offered sacrifices for the family. They were the priest, in other words, we might say. They were the go-between between the family and God. That's another clue that tells us when he lived. James, the brother of Jesus, in James 5 and 11 also talks about Job displaying perseverance and patience during suffering. I'll bring that up again later. Okay. And so Job was so concerned that his family or one of his sons might have sinned during their feasting that he offered these sacrifices. Not that he even knew that they sinned. He just wanted to be super safe, on the safe side, didn't he? And let's see here. I had a thought. Well, it left me. Maybe it'll come back. Okay, let's look at verses 6 through 8. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man and one who fears God and shuns evil?" For some time I had, this verse 6 kind of bothered me, because we know that no evil thing or no sin can exist in heaven. And I thought, well, why did God allow Satan to come back into heaven? Well, maybe he did, and maybe he didn't. Did this take place in heaven? I'm thinking that it probably did, But I guess maybe the better answer, at least in my mind, you may have never even thought of this, I don't know, but maybe the answer that maybe the answer is that we know that after time is over, when the earth is destroyed, when God collects his the souls that have been obedient and all the angels and all the heavenly hosts into heaven, there will never again be any sin in heaven. We know that there was some to start with because as far as Satan goes, because that's why he was cast out, wasn't it? So, and this is kind of a side point, but
I guess if this was in heaven, are the sons of God, is that the angels?
Yeah, I was just going to ask that. Who are the sons of God? The righteous angels. And it says Satan also came among them. Maybe some of his angels were with him. We don't know. We're not told here, but we do know Satan was there. And did God have to ask Satan where he was? No, he knew. He knew. But we're told this for our benefit, aren't we? And what had Satan been, what had he been doing? Now, we know what it says here, but really, what was it that he was doing on the earth?
Spreading evil.
Yeah?
Tempting people. And
he was seeking the souls of men, wasn't he? Ultimately, he was seeking. He was going about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour.
In doing this, he was trying to he would try to discredit God.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how he won people over. That was the beginning.
Yeah, and I can't help but think. I mean, maybe you do too, but I still think that you know God was just toying with him when he said, "Well, did you see Job? Check him out. There's no one like him." And of course, Satan took the bait. Satan knew who he was already. He says, well, yeah, he's righteous. Why wouldn't he be? Look what you've done for him. You built this wall around him. It calls a hedge. Verse 9 says, haven't you made a hedge around him, around his household and all that he has on every side? You've given him all these possessions. You give him all these great things. Why wouldn't he obey you? But, he says, take all that away from him. See what he does. Let's see if he's righteous when you do all that, God. And Satan said, or God says, okay, you've got power over him, but you don't touch him. Don't touch him, but you can do whatever else you want. So it says Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And then verse 13, there's a time span here. We're not told how much, but Satan picked his day, if you think about it. He picked a day, and all these things in the rest of this chapter, I believe, happened in the same day, pretty much at the same time. Here are his sons and daughters, verse 13, were having a feast. They were in the older brother's house. And the Sabaeans, verse 15, came and stole all of the oxen, the donkeys. They killed all the servants. And he said, I alone have escaped to tell you. And we see this repeated two or three times. What's the thought along with this messenger? Well, I kind of gave it away there. But the one servant that escaped. That was a common practice when, during war, if you totally annihilated the enemy, at times you might leave a person or two alive to go back to the country they were from and say, tell what horrible, horrible things had happened. Because if word didn't get back to them, then they might not have lived in fear of you.
They wanted credit for it.
They did. Absolutely. They were vicious, ruthless people, and they wanted everybody to know it. Okay, verse 16. Another servant comes and says, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. Well, was it the fire from God? I thought Satan was in charge here doing this. It was Satan. But obviously the messenger was mistaken. Whether there was fire that actually fell from heaven or whether there was a fire started, I'm not sure. It may have been, yeah. But we know that this was not from God in this instance because God, this was all from Satan. Verse 17, here's another one that came. The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels, and killed all the servants, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And verse 18, there's another one, the real bad one. Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and a great wind came from the wilderness, struck the four corners, and they're all dead. Collapsed the house on them. Wow. That's just more than anybody ought to have to experience, isn't it? And all at one time.
Now I'm wondering, did Satan have control over the elements? Or was this God simply allowing that to happen further the test of Job?
Well, I don't know, but we do know that God allowed Satan to work miracles at times. When Moses went to Pharaoh and his magicians turned their sticks into snakes, that was a miracle, as I understand it, and at other times, but the power of God always overcame the miracles of Satan. Always, there was always more power in the good than the bad. Yeah, yeah. We know that God did not tempt Job or any other man, but he did allow this great test. And Satan, of course, was tempting. Okay, we've got to keep moving here. So let's look at how Job reacts to all this tragedy. Verse 20. Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. Wow. Is that something we would do? Does that sound normal? Of course not. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. So Job's response to all this tragedy was humility and worship of God. And he remained obedient. All right. Keep thinking in your mind there about things we can learn for today. I'm going to go on into chapter 2 here. It's not going to take very long. We're not going to go through all of it anyhow. And then we'll drop back and we'll discuss application. Okay. For chapter 2, there was another day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came among them also. This is a repeat. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Same answer, been on the earth, going to and fro. God said, "Have you considered my servant Job? He still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." So God's kind of rubbing it in, we might say, isn't he? Ah, see there? He didn't sin. You took everything he had. And Satan's got another answer. Oh, yes, but a man will give anything for his life. And that's a pretty true statement, isn't it? That's pretty true. You let me touch him, God. You let me touch his life, touch his health, and we'll see what happens then. He'll curse you to his face. Verse 6, the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life." So the way I read this, and from what we see happen, Satan brought him to the point of death, to the very point of death, but still, we know he was faithful. Verse 7, so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. If boils aren't the most painful thing, they've got to be right there with whatever else you might think is. I know our physical bodies experience a lot of different types of pain that sometimes we can control, sometimes we can't control. And of course, Job couldn't. Some of the reading I did on this, and when you think about a boil, what is a boil? It's a big blister that festers, and they can break and ooze and just really get nasty. And pain is just almost beyond belief. And Job had them everywhere. And he had no doctor. He had no medical attention. He had no painkiller, as far as I know. I mean, I'm sure they had some types of painkillers in that time, but we're not told that he took any. You know, when Christ was offered a painkiller on the cross, he refused it, didn't he? So Job sat with a piece of broken pottery in the ashes and scraped his sores as they ran and festered. Can you imagine what he looked like and how he felt? Okay. So then he has another dagger, you might say, from Satan. Probably not nearly as painful at first, at least, as the loss of his children, but his wife turned on him and said, just curse God and die. I mean, why not? And she didn't just say it one time. This continued on through the book. Okay? This continued on.
So we have to remember, definitely, she doesn't have the faith of Job. But she did have suffered the same losses. She lost all of her children.
True.
So she was, they took it two different ways.
Yeah. Good point.
That's a good lesson.
Yeah, good point. And, you know, here's another thing about Job. I think one of the reasons he was probably so righteous was we have no mention of him ever having more than one wife, do we? But it was common practice. And God did not necessarily condemn that, because many of the righteous men in the Old Testament had more than one wife. David, Abraham. But yet, that's not the way God wanted it, was it? From the beginning, he says, one woman, one man. But we just see Job, we only see one wife mentioned, and I'm taking that to that he only had one wife. Okay. So, that's about where I want to break off here chapter 2. I will mention that this is when Job's wife and his three friends enter the story. We've got Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They came from far away, and without getting too much into next week, they had agreed upon a day to come together to go see Job. Well, this tells me passage of time occurred. We don't really know exactly how long this whole affliction took, but it was some time. And they had traveled to meet there and comfort Job. And when they came and they saw him from a distance, they knew it was him, but they couldn't believe it was him from his appearance. They didn't recognize his appearance, even though they knew it was him. Have you ever had that? Experience? And it may just have been that you haven't seen someone for a long time and said, oh, you look different. Well, you gained a little weight. Or your hair's gray. I hear that a lot. Or whatever. But, you know, that would have been nice if they could have said that to Job. That he was in such a horrible physical shape that they sat down in the dirt and nobody said anything for a week. Isn't that amazing? That's how great the sorrow was. Okay. So, what are some lessons that you can take away from this and that we can put into practice in our lives today?
Mike, one of the things that comes to my mind when I think about this story of Job, I think it gives us some insight on how Satan operates. I used to think at one time that Satan could know my thoughts. Satan knew everything about me, and that was very troubling. I think some of us have wicked thoughts that we don't know where they come from and how they get in our mind. And that was troubling to me to think, well, Satan knows my weaknesses. He knows my thoughts. Well, I don't think that's the case. And you ask, well, why did Satan have to go to and fro through the earth? Why did he have to do that? Because he doesn't know the thoughts of men. He has to visually see it himself. He has to lay eyes on it himself. He has to know what people are doing to tempt them with. He had to see Job. What are the things that are going to tempt Job? If you look at Satan and how he operated with Jesus, when Satan tried to tempt Jesus three times.
Mm-hmm.
If Satan knew the mind of Jesus, would he have asked him those questions? When he tried to tempt him with bread, he could see that Jesus was hungry.
But right.
He know that Jesus was going to answer those the way he did. He could see that people in the world didn't. Some people didn't want to worship Jesus. Satan said, "I'll give you these things." But he didn't know the mind of Jesus, and I don't think Satan knows what's in our mind. And that gives us, I think, some hope to know that we need to be very careful of the things that we're putting in our minds, because Satan can see that. If he does have the same power today as he did in the time of Job, we need to be very careful what we're looking at, what we're putting in our mind, what we're surrounding ourselves, because those are the things that he possibly can see, and then use those things against us.
Yeah, it's we know that he knows that man is prone to sin. He knows that we will sin. You know, I think there's a lot of unknowns about what Satan does know. I was just looking, turned back to the story of Satan and Eve, you know, in the garden. And of course, he knew that God had already told her not to eat of the tree, her and Adam both. And he says, "Did God tell you not to eat of the tree?" Of course, that doesn't mean that he knew her mind, but he knows that we are prone to sin. And so the story went on from there. So that's a good thought. That's a big subject that you brought up there.
I had never really thought about that, but I think Drew's head is onto something there, maybe. Because, you know, Satan was there in the beginning, just like you said, Mike. He was there in the beginning. He saw how it happened. And so he carried on with that. He walked to and fro, and he tries them on everybody, even on us.
Yeah. And in connection with this, I was wanting to mention this anyhow. Back to James 5 and 11 that I mentioned earlier. James was talking about righteous people being oppressed here in James 5. And he makes an example of the farmer in verse 7. He has to be patient, wait for the rain. Says, don't grumble against one another. And then he says in verse 10, "My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience." And I would include Job in this, even though he's not called a prophet. "Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful." Maybe someone can refresh my memory. Where's the verse that says, "What if God?" What if God was willing to do certain things? I thought I had that verse wrote down, but I guess I didn't. Here we go. Romans 9. That's what I was looking for. Romans 9 and 20. "But indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, 'Why have you made me like this?'" This goes to Job's later discourse with God. "Does not the potter have power over the clay from the same lump to make one vessel for honor and another for dishonor?" Here we go, verse 22. "What if God, wanting to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath prepared for destruction," etc., etc. Okay, we don't know all the things that the reasons God does things. We don't know all the ways that Satan has either, probably. These are heavenly beings. There's a lot about that we don't know and are probably not supposed to be troubled about. And maybe that'll be revealed later after our death. But you know, this whole book of Job, what if God was willing to use Job as an example for us? Well, he was, wasn't he? Okay, what else can we... There's a really big application I see in the last... in that verse 21 of chapter 1.
Really, I think it emphasizes to us the importance of making sure our children are raised to understand the fear of the Lord and devote everything we can to help them understand that and make sure that they're on the right path. And yet, that is not what our salvation hinges upon. We have our own relationship. So if they're taken away, if they make bad decisions, our relationship with God still has to stand strong.
Yeah. We just need to make sure we've done our duty at the appropriate time in regards to our children.
Yeah.
Very good.
I think that verse 20 through 22 is really important for us because look at his response. You've had your worst day ever, all this loss, and everything's gone, and how does he handle it? He doesn't accuse God. He doesn't get angry with God. He falls to the ground.
And why was he able to do that? I guess is what I'm getting at. Why was he able? I'm not sure I could do that. Well, why was Job able to do that?
He realizes, as he said in verse 21, I didn't have anything.
Right.
I came into this world with nothing.
Right.
And so he's good at keeping things in perspective.
Yeah.
Say.
And he was brought up as the most patient man. Isn't there a scripture that says patience of Job?
Well, James talks about him as being consider the perseverance and patience of Job. Yeah, I guess what I got from verse 21 was he placed God above everything else, everything, even his children, and certainly all his possessions. And that's how he was able to understand that God was still to be worshipped. Even though these calamities happened on me, he had faith. And you know, faith sometimes is just is not knowing the end, what the end might be of a problem or a situation, but having the faith that it's going to work out. It's going to be in our best interest if we're still faithful to God, even though we may not understand. Job didn't understand it. He struggled throughout the whole book to try to understand. And his friends, you know, piled on, you know, well, you've got to have done something wrong. You know, this just doesn't happen for no reason, Job. They piled it on him day after day.
And Jesus reaffirmed all that in the New Testament when he said, he who loves mother, father, son, or daughter
right.
is not worthy of me.
Right.
Job kind of teaches the same thing.
Yeah, and I certainly think this is one way we could say that Job was, why he was called the most righteous man. Well, God says there is none like him on the earth at this particular point in time, anyhow. All right, thanks for your thoughts, and we'll try to finish up Job next week, and we'll take about a 5-10 minute break here while the kids come up.